Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Prep Life Podcast. This is your founder and CEO of Glam Girl Bikini, Amy Anger. Today, I am joined with not one, but two fabulous people. So first of all, Chris, could you introduce yourself?
Yes. Hey, guys, this is Chris Nicole, Glam Girl Bikini Coach and IFBB Bikini Pro.
And our special guest today is Dr. Bill Campbell. He's a professor of exercise science and the director of the Performance and Physique Enhancement Laboratory at the University of South Florida. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with him and have heard him talk on several different podcasts, but his research is focused primarily on helping people optimize their physiques with a maintainable lifestyle. So he is a very decorated researcher and author and has many publications. Dr. Bill Campbell, welcome to the show. Thank you for being on today.
Yes, thank you guys for the invitation. I'm looking forward to having a conversation.
So is there anything off of your bio that you would like to share before we get started with questions and in your introduction to our audience?
If anybody wants to follow what I do, I'm only active at one place, which is on Instagram, and that's at Bill Campbell, PhD. I also recently wrote a guidebook. It's like an ebook. And if anybody's interested in that, I'm sure we'll be talking, probably everything we're going to talk about is in that guidebook. But the link to my bio on my Instagram page will take you right to the sales page.
Perfect. Awesome. Okay. So Chris, why don't you start with the first question?
Sure. Okay. So Dr. Campbell, I was listening to a previous podcast where you were interviewed, and I have to say, I think it's really special that you mentioned that you do predominantly work with a lot of females in your research and your study. And I know that you work with trained or fitness type of population, not necessarily bodybuilders. I know you made that very clear. But what have you noticed about protein intake specifically for females when maintaining or trying to gain muscle versus like a male?
My observation has been that I would say I don't see a difference. I wouldn't prescribe a different protein intake strategy for male versus female. As you kind of alluded to, most of my research on protein intake has been in females. And actually, we just finished another study this past spring, another protein study in females. So that will be an addition to that line of research. The one difference would be, and again, this isn't something that I've researched, but it's something that I've noticed in my research, males will tend to drink crap or stuff that tastes like chalk. And females tend to be a little bit more picky. Like they're a little more quick to say, I don't like this one, or so I would say, and again, I don't have research on this. My impression is that the taste, the texture, the being GI friendly, I think females are a little bit more aware of that for themselves than the males, in my experience.
That's very interesting. So we have a refined palate.
I like the way you phrased that. I was trying to smooth it out, but not doing a good job. I wanted to say they complain more, but then nobody wants to hear that.
That's true. Yes. Well, we can relate to that. Okay. So you haven't, so the parameters are pretty much similar from what you've uncovered as far as like putting on muscle tissue and retaining muscle tissue when it comes to their overall protein intake.
Yes. And that kind of makes sense because physiologically, the muscle protein synthetic response is no different between a male and a female. Now, if protein intake and gaining muscle mass was, let's say, more hormonal, which, you know, let's just say it influenced testosterone, well, then we might have differences. But knowing that that's not the case, muscle protein synthesis is it's not really dependent on testosterone. At least it has to be at base levels. I don't see a physiological reason why I would prescribe differently from a male to a female.
Great. Okay, thank you so much for answering that.
Yeah. So I wanted to get your take here on your three rules of dieting in relation to physique athletes.
Okay. I wrote a book actually 8 years ago now. It was a textbook, and one of the chapters was on body composition, and I was doing the research for that. And those, as I was looking, I was really focused on the fat loss research in lean people. And those principles just kind of made their self, you know, kind of came out at the top. I'm like, wow, there wasn't a lot of research, but they were kind of abundantly clear. And those three principles are now, let me just set the stage. The three principles for fat loss. So when I say fat loss, that implies we're targeting the loss of weight from body fat compartments. So we actually care about how we're losing the weight or where it's coming from. So principle number one is to lose fat slowly or lose weight slowly, whatever you want to choose. Number two is do not decrease protein when dieting. So when you start a diet, let's reduce from carbs and fat. Let's not reduce from protein. And of course, there's exceptions to that, but they would be rare. And then the third one is make sure that you're resistance training when dieting. So those three principles, they all converge on two things. They all will cause the maintenance of muscle mass when dieting. So they will preserve the muscle that you've worked for a long time to build. And they also, relatedly, they keep metabolic rate as high as it can be when dieting. So it will, usually when you lose body weight, your metabolism is suppressed. Following those three principles not only maintains your muscle mass as good as possible, it also maintains your metabolic rate as good as possible.
Okay, great. Thank you. Chris, you want to take the next one? We can talk about the metabolic rate, the RMR in females.
Okay. So my other question is, what do you find as the best way of predicting RMR in females?
Oh, that's a good question. And the reason I'm not the best is because I actually measure it in my lab on every subject. So I don't really have a need like you guys as coaches. I don't have to predict it, because I measure it. So that, you know, predictions just try to get you close to what the truth is. And then I actually measure the truth, because we're measuring their resting metabolic rate. But one of the comparators that we use in my research is the Harris-Benedict equation. And I don't remember the exact equation, but if you Google Harris-Benedict equation, that will give you, you know, you put in a female's height, weight, age, and that's probably about it. And it will give you an estimation of her resting metabolic rate. And in my experience, what we measure compared to that formula, the Harris-Benedict equation, is always pretty close. It's rare that it's off by more than a few percent. Now, other equations that I like, and the reason I like them is because they also will factor in a fat-free mass or a muscle mass component. The Cunningham equation is very simple, so I don't know if you've ever heard of that one. There's a Mifflin-St. Jure. That's another equation.
That's the one we use. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So, that one I like. And then you can actually get to very, like, on-the-spot estimations where you just take somebody's body weight and multiply it by, you know, 10 or 12 or 13. Those tend to be not as close as those other equations. So if you use the Mifflin-St. Jure, I think that the top three are the ones that I mentioned. If you're going to use an equation, Harris-Benedict, Mifflin-St. Jure, and the Cunningham equation, those would be the three that I think get the closest.
So when you say that you test it in your lab, you're using the breath test with the mask. Is that what you're using?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Instead of a mask, we actually put like a plastic bubble over their head.
Oh.
Same principle though. We're capturing the oxygen that they're consuming and the carbon dioxide that they're breathing out. And then that allows us to estimate how many calories they are burning.
Okay. Can you share with us too, just as a side thing, what you use what your best measurement tool for testing body fat in your labs?
Yeah, we use ultrasound technology, and there are, let's just, I mean, we all know there's skin folds, there's ultrasound, there's bod pod, DEXA, underwater water weighing's not as popular, but it used to be. And I've used everything except for bod pod professionally and actually when I would work with clients. The reason I personally like ultrasound and skin folds for that matter is you're actually measuring body fat. So when I put the ultrasound wand on somebody, it's sending a sound wave through their body, and that sound wave gets reflected at what we would say tissue interfaces. So where the body fat meets the muscle, that's like an interface, and that will reflect that sound wave. And as that sound wave's being reflected, that allows us to measure in millimeters how thick the fat is. So the reason I love that is ultrasound is literally measuring body fat. Almost all of the other products or methods don't actually measure body fat. Now, I can explain that a little bit. So that's what I like. If somebody loses body fat, the ultrasound picks that up immediately, and it's right in front of your eyes. Same thing is true with skin folds. When you pinch somebody's fat, what are you pinching? You're pinching body fat. And of course, you have to be good at pinching and using that. So a beginner I wouldn't trust a beginner, but somebody experienced is an experienced skin fold technician is great. And again, we use skin folds in my lab as a backup in case our technology fails. So I have a lot of faith in a trained skin fold technician. Now, obviously you also are pinching two layers of skin, so that you just have to, you have to know that. The other methods, I have no problems with any of the other methods. As long as you use the same method at the beginning and the end. So you want to make sure that you're using the same unit and ideally the same technician if there's a technician involved. But like bod pod as an example, bod pod's not measuring body fat. Bod pod is technically measuring the amount of air that you displace in a capsule. DEXA is measuring realistically pixels on a screen. Now, those pixels are related to muscle, fat, and bone, so the different densities of tissue, but it's not actually measuring fat the way that an ultrasound does. Then you have BIA, bioelectrical impedance. We also use that in my lab. That's not measuring body fat. What that's measuring is, for lack of a better explanation, how fast an electrical current travels through your body, and that will be slower or faster depending on how much muscle and fat you have.
Right.
But all of them will give you an estimation of body fat, but we do have to realize none of them, BIA, DEXA, underwater weighing, what was the other one, bod pod, they're not actually measuring body fat like ultrasound does or skin fold. So here's an example. If I had somebody come in, let's say at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I tested them on all these machines, and then I gave them a huge breakfast buffet, and then 30 minutes later, I measured them again. The data is going to not be valid on all of those machines, except for ultrasound and skin fold. It really doesn't matter what's in your belly, because I would not expect a huge breakfast, or if you drank a gallon of water, that's not going to influence the thickness of that fat. So that's another reason I like it. Yeah, so it just goes to what is the device actually meant to measure, and are you capturing that? Now, I also do need to say this. I go ahead and use our ultrasound, and we input it into a body fat percentage equation where all of those limitations would apply. But I think the smartest person would get somebody that can do that is great with skin folds, and you just add up the sum of the skin folds. Let's say you test three places or seven places on the body. Don't worry about what your body fat percentage is. Just add up how thick the fat is. And at the end of your diet, do it again. And when you have a reduction in those numbers, you can be extremely confident you've lost fat. And it has nothing to do with retaining water, or is there food in your system, or is the scale a pound off? Really now, I know nobody wants to. Yeah.
Very good insight. Yeah, I like that. I used to do skin folds, I mean, religiously. And I never thought to just use the actual measurement as their tool, because a lot of times athletes would get frustrated, you know, because the equation, you know, you have to put in your weight. So, and that can fluctuate, yes, like you said. So I like that.
It is the best and the most scientific way to do it, but nobody wants to, even though I know that, I always want to know my body fat percent because I'm just curious and I've been doing it forever. But yeah, if you want to take out any guessing or just, if you just want as close to the true value of what's happening in your body, that would be what I would recommend.
Love that. Yeah. And it's very easy to have that, access to that. It's much more cost effective than a DEXA scan and things like that. So, Chris, did you want to take the next question?
I actually had a question to piggyback off of that. So, Dr. Campbell, you talked about how you measure body fat. When you're doing research and you're trying to measure muscle tissue, what do you utilize to kind of to measure that?
So I'll say what I do, which isn't much, and then I'll tell you what my colleague does, which is better.
Sure.
So what we do is we take somebody's body weight. Let's say they weigh 200 pounds. We measure how much body fat they have on their body. Let's say they have 50 pounds of body fat. And then what's left is 150 pounds. Next, we measure body water. So we'll subtract body water. And let's just make this easy. Let's say the body water is 50 pounds. So we started with 200 pounds. 50 pounds of that was fat. 50 pounds of that was water. What's left is what we call dry fat-free mass. Now, that means that it's not all muscle. There's bones, there's, you know, organs, liver, skin, spleen, heart. But there's the largest part of that is skeletal muscle. And the skeletal muscle, if you've been doing training, like resistance training, that's going to be the most adaptable. I really don't think anybody would expect your heart to increase by 10% or decrease. I really don't think you're going to lose 10% of your bone mineral density in these 10 or 12 week studies.
We call it
fat-free mass, but any change, I believe, and so does, I mean, the profession, the, you know, the academic profession also agrees you can attribute those changes to changes in muscle mass. Are we actually measuring the amount of muscle mass with that? No. We're measuring body weight, fat, and water, and then making the assumption that any changes in that leftover area is due to muscle. And again, maybe it's 90%, maybe it's 98, 94, I don't know. But we have a lot of confidence that that is reflective of gains or losses of muscle. Now, I have a colleague, Dr. Sam Buckner, who runs our muscle lab. He uses B-mode ultrasound, which is a higher level ultrasound than what I use. And that's where he's actually going in and measuring the muscle thickness of the, just like we do with body fat.
Yeah.
But now this one is a more powerful ultrasound and it will tell you the thickness of the muscle. So that is a better method to say, did you gain or lose muscle?
Awesome.
Same.
Love that. Okay. So I'm going to kind of switch gears here to some of your research. I am particularly interested in your refeed study that you did. Can you share with us what your findings were from that study?
Yeah. So the subjects in that study were resistance trained males and females. So just to give an idea of the type of subjects that I study, as you stated earlier, the primary clientele that I serve, or the type of person, is the serious fitness enthusiast. They are not necessarily wanting to step on a bodybuilding stage, but they want to look like they could. So they're pretty much living a bodybuilding lifestyle, most of them, without stepping on stage. And I love bodybuilding. I love the lifestyle. I love the discipline that bodybuilders have in their lifestyle. So I learn almost everything from bodybuilders. They're the experts in fat loss. So everything I do is influenced by bodybuilding science. And then I like to think what I do is I just dial it back a notch or two so that me and my wife can implement it in our lives, or that most people can. Again, most people aren't going to step on stage, and there's peaking strategies there. There's, you know, there's all kinds of things that I'm not investigating. But if you think of off seasons or just the general lifestyle of a bodybuilder, that's who I serve. This particular study, we had the question, is it better to do a linear diet, meaning that you're in a caloric deficit all the time for, let's say, 8 weeks, actually it was 7 weeks straight, or can we manipulate your calories so that you're not in a constant caloric deficit? So I sometimes will call that study our weekday diet study. Because what we did, we had two groups of people. One group, we said, for 7 straight weeks, you are going to be in a 25% caloric deficit. All 7 days per week for 7 straight weeks, 49 days, you will be dieting. The other group, we said, you are going to diet 5 days out of 7. But on the weekends, we're going to let you increase your calories back to what it was before you started the diet. So 5 days, you're going to have to diet, and you're actually going to have to diet a little harder than the other group, because on the weekends, we're going to let you increase your calories. So they, on Monday through Friday, those males and females who were resistance trained, they reduced their calories 35% from baseline. And then on the weekends, they were back to 100% of their calories compared to baseline. And then the other group was 25% every time. And at the end of the week, both groups were in an average 25% caloric restriction. So our question was, is one of these systems going to be better? Is one group going to lose more fat? Is one group going to lose more muscle, or gain more muscle, or maintain muscle? What's the impact on metabolic rate? So in theory, there really shouldn't be any difference, because at the end of the week or at the end of the 7 weeks, everybody had the same deficit. But what we found, oh, and it's also important to note, we had them increase their calories on the weekend they had to use carbs. So we wanted them to really increase their carbs on the weekends. And everybody had to ingest, I think it was 1.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight, which was, I don't know, it's close to like 0.8 grams per pound, somewhere around there. At the end of the 7 weeks, both groups lost the same amount of body fat. Both groups lost the same amount of body weight, approximately. But the group that cycled their diet, that increased their calories on the weekends, they were able to maintain their dry fat-free mass significantly better than the other group. Both groups lost some, let's just call it muscle mass. It'll be easier for me to say that. Both groups did lose muscle mass, but the group that increased their calories on the weekends did not lose as much. In fact, it was significantly less muscle mass than the other group. And then we also saw the same thing with resting metabolic rate. The group that increased their calories on the weekends, they had a 40 calorie per day decrease in resting metabolic rate, where the other group had a double that. They were like 80 calories per day. And that makes sense. If you're retaining more muscle, your metabolic rate's directly correlated with your muscle mass. So it would make sense that your metabolic rate wouldn't be suppressed either.
Sure.
So that's what we found.
Very good. Okay, Chris, do you want to take the next question?
Well, I think so. That actually, you already answered one of my questions with that study, so that's perfect. If we're talking about fat loss and we're kind of shifting into gears, what does it actually mean to burn fat?
So, yeah, burning fat, and this is a concept that I kind of drill to my students. Burning fat is different than liberating fat. So burning fat is when you actually lose fat. But it's a two-step process to burn fat. Your body just doesn't burn fat out, you know, when you exercise or diet. What has to happen first is you have these fat cells. And I'm looking at my stomach now. I have a lot of them there currently. So these fat cells have to liberate the fat inside of them. And that's a process. I mean, the science word there is called lipolysis, or the breakdown of fat. Mm-hmm. So we have to break down the body fat, where the fat cells are literally breaking apart and releasing the fat in the form of fatty acids into the blood. And now we hope to be able to burn them. Once we burn them, they're gone. Like, they're no longer on our body. We actually look leaner. But we have to liberate them first, or break down the fat. And then the next step is burning the fat. And we, the scientific term for that is called beta oxidation. And that is the goal. And what happens with that is that basically these fatty acids, just your body just keeps chopping them up and making them shorter and shorter until they're no longer even recognizable as a fat. And ultimately, we breathe it out as carbon dioxide. So that's the difference. And the reason that's important is, as an example, your body's constantly breaking down fat. You're constantly releasing these fatty acids into the blood. But if you don't have a drive to burn it, they turn right back around, and then they get right, they turn back into the fat cell. That's referred to as a futile cycle. So that's really why exercise and a caloric deficit are so effective. Exercise and caloric deficits kind of guarantee that the fat that's being broken down is actually going to be burned for energy. So there's the difference. And even if you take caffeine as an example, caffeine does a great job of breaking down fat, but it doesn't burn all of it. Now, it does burn a lot of it, but not all of it. So that's why I'm a huge proponent. If you're trying to lose fat, you have to either exercise, or you're going to have to be in a caloric deficit, or you can get liposuction, but that's a different topic. I look at those things as like the magnets. You want to have a magnet inside your cells, which is the mitochondria, where that burning of fat actually takes place.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so can you share what was most interesting about your rapid fat loss study?
Yeah, the most interesting thing was it makes me contradict, or it makes me have to talk more about violating my first principle that I talked about earlier. So earlier I said, don't lose weight fast, right? That's my first principle.
Right, right.
Yep. So then what did my lab do? Well, my students want to design a study where we're going to violate that principle. And we did, and it really didn't cause the damage that I thought it would. Now, there are some caveats to that. So what we did in this study was we had people go on a caloric deficit that was, I don't know if you, severe is the right word, but it was about 37.5%. So that's definitely not an easy caloric deficit. Mm-mm. And we did this for a 2-week period, which is a rapid fat loss protocol. And these people were all resistance training, and they were continuing to do whatever cardio they were doing before the study. And what we found, like, again, what I used to always say was, if you lose fat too fastly, you're going to suppress your metabolic rate and you're going to lose muscle mass. So I fully anticipated in my study that's going to happen. Now, we did do two things to help prevent that. We followed principles 2 and 3. We made sure that our subjects were taking a high protein diet. So they had to be ingesting 2.2 grams of protein per kg. And of course, as I already said, they were all resistance training. But after this 2-week diet, they lost a significant amount of body fat, but they did not lose muscle mass, which was surprising to me. And I now have to kind of put a disclaimer on my principle. I think you can be a very aggressive in a fat loss or a caloric deficit as long as it is very short. I believe had we done this for 4 weeks or 6 weeks, there would have been significant losses in muscle mass. But if you're going to be aggressive, as long as it's short term, let's say 2 weeks or less, as long as your protein is high, at least 1 gram per pound, and as long as you're resistance training, my data would suggest that you can target nearly all body fat. Now, resting metabolic rate did decrease. So we weren't able to prevent that from decreasing. I think it decreased by about 5%. So that's even more evidence that in the long term, this is going to be harder to sustain if it were to keep going on. So there's my quick description of that rapid fat loss study that we did last year.
Did you happen to collect any data with the subjects after finishing the 2 weeks of dieting and what happened with them?
Yeah, we did another 2 weeks. So everybody had to do the diet. So everybody averaged 37.5% for 2 weeks. Then we said, after that, you can do whatever you want. If you want to continue to diet, continue to diet. If you want to go to all the buffets you want, whatever you want to do. Do what you want, but just come back and let us test you after another 2 weeks. And on average, the subjects were still in a caloric deficit. It was a 15% caloric deficit. So it went from nearly 40% down to a 15% caloric deficit. So they were still technically dieting, but mm-hmm. in their minds, that's a big jump up in calories from nearly 40. So it's funny because I did the same protocol myself, and I remember thinking, wow, this is so nice to increase my food, even though it's still not a lot of food. And what we found was, at that point, we returned metabolic rate almost to baseline, so we recovered any of that damage that was done. They maintained all of their fat loss, and I guess that makes sense. They were still in a deficit. Mm-hmm. And they actually increased a tiny bit this dry fat-free mass measure. So at the end of this month of dieting, from about a nearly 40% and then down to 15%, the only outcome was a loss of fat and no loss of muscle mass. Now, one thing, did they gain muscle mass? Not really. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's – You're always going to trade probably gaining muscle mass if you're going to take that approach. But I always encourage people, define your goal and then target that. Like if you're going to try to gain muscle, go after it. If you're trying to lose fat, go after that. Don't dance around both sides of your goal equation, so to speak.
When you talk about that, it reminds me a little bit of like a reverse diet. And, you know, somebody's going through peak week and they're pretty low in their deficit. And then, you know, we usually, it depends on the athlete. Everything is context dependent on what we need to do in the reverse phase. But have you found any sort of research or like the best way that we could support our athletes during a reverse dieting phase with the research that you've seen in this? Or I don't even know if there are other studies that are similar to kind of what you just did, but.
Well, I'm not aware of any reverse diet research. Now, my lab, we did a case series studies where we followed 7 bodybuilders and bikini competitors. I think 4 were male and 3 female. And this was, again, so we followed them. So what we followed them specifically, they all competed in either a bodybuilding figure or bikini competition. And then we followed him for, I think it was 8 weeks or 10 weeks after.
Okay.
And my grad student, James Longstrom, designed this study. And it was really cool. And we actually tried to set this up, and we failed. But we tried to say, hey, we want you to either follow a reverse diet or a recovery diet. Now, are you guys familiar with the concept of a recovery?
Yes. But, okay. And we've talked about it on our podcast before. But if you can just, for our listeners' sake, kind of explain both of those and the differences.
Yeah. So a reverse diet would be when your diet is over, or for like a competitive bodybuilder, when they're off the weeks after their competition, they're extremely lean. They have 2 choices. They can either gradually increase their calories and slowly put on body fat and get their bodies more adjusted to training heavy again, hopefully sleeping better. So that's called that's a reverse diet where you're a little bit more slow to increase calories. And the other option is called a recovery diet where you kind of throw in a lot of calories immediately and get body fat back on, and you're not really concerned about taking your time. So people will use both approaches. Obviously, that first approach, the reverse diet, is a much more disciplined approach. And in my world, that speaks to me more because, again, I'm a lifestyle person. I want to be lean all the time. And after a diet, I'd like to look like I'm still lean. And that reverse diet keeps you in that condition longer. So that's my bias. I like that approach. So we told people, we're not going to tell you what to do, but just tell us, are you going to do a reverse or a recovery? And it didn't matter what they told us. Nobody really did what they said. The reverse people
it's so hard
didn't
after
stick with their
show.
Plan. Very hard. The recovery people, I guess they did, but pretty much everybody went to a recovery, even if they had intentions of doing a reverse. So what we did was instead of using the context of a recovery versus reverse diet, we just said, here's what happens post-show. And the results were kind of what you would expect. The novice people, I think we had two that were novice, they put on a lot of body fat. And one of them, it was not pleasant. I mean, it was a lot of body fat in the 8 weeks. And then our more, because we had a couple natural, these were all natural competitors.
Okay.
At least three of them were at the professional level, IFBB, or some other natural organization.
Okay.
But all competitors were natural. And they were much better at being, putting on fat a little bit slower. And most of them were working with coaches throughout. So I think that's the only research you're going to find that it even attempted to look at a reverse versus recovery. And that article, by the way, it's freely available. It's published.
Oh, awesome.
And it kind of, yeah, yeah.
Did you have any questions regarding that study, Chris?
No, I don't think so. Not in the reversing.
Okay. If you want to go to your next question, you can.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're done reversing. We're going back to dieting. So are there specific principles or things that you've seen consistent in your research that can make it more that can guarantee or make it more probable that a person would burn fat for energy versus muscle? Like, what types of parameters do they need to set to kind of make sure that they're using one energy source over another?
So that's not something that I've done research on, but that's I would say that's a little bit more just general physiology or metabolic physiology knowledge.
Okay.
So, and that I'll say that can be somewhat of a trap. If you want to burn fat, or if you want to burn most of your calories from fat,
yeah,
the best thing you can do is nothing. Just I'm sitting in my office chair and I'm burning most of my calories from fat because that's how the body works. When you're at rest or doing very low intensity exercise, most of the calories you're burning are coming from fat. Now, of course, the trade-off is I'm not burning many calories now. The right. other extreme of this is if I were in a dead sprint, so I'm sprinting as fast as I can for 100 yards, I'm burning 100% carbohydrates, zero fat. Mm-hmm. But I'm burning a lot of calories during that period of time. So the intensity of the exercise is what determines the energy source of your body's storage. So if you want to burn carbs, sprint or do resistance training. If you want to burn fat, go for a walk. But again, I think that's not the best way to approach how to lose body fat. What I think is the approach is what every bodybuilder does. They might just not know it. What they do is they control total calories. So if they want to lose fat, they're burning more calories than what they're consuming. Mm-hmm. And then they're helping their bodies maintain their muscle mass with high protein, with resistance training. So there's it's more of a just a simple energy balance approach. And that's not sexy, and nobody wants to admit that. they want to get, you know, how do I maximize fat loss? And I would say this, though, if you exercise in the fasted state, so first thing in the morning, you are going to tend to burn more body fat. But the research, and I'm aware of about 5 studies that have looked at this, it doesn't really, for whatever reason, manifest in actually losing more body fat. I would say if you're trying to hack your body, for lack of a better term, take caffeine, exercise after that without eating any food, and the caffeine liberates a lot of these fatty acids, and then the exercise, the cardio that you're going to do afterwards burns it. That's probably the best thing, or if, I don't know if you, him being, if you're familiar with that supplement. Mm-hmm. Both of those will encourage the body to burn more fat, especially when followed with aerobic exercise.
So this is actually starting to make a lot of sense. I really appreciate your explanation. So would you say, you know, how you're talking about the 2 ways that, you know, you have to free the fat, like release it, and then utilize it for energy. Would you say that goes like pretty similar with resistance training, doing more of like the freeing, and then the aerobic doing more of the burning, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I would. I mean, they both, the resistance training burns more carbs in general, but they're also this fat burning. So both resistance training will cause lipolysis, so it will cause the fat cells to release the fatty acids into the blood, and then because you're active, your body needs energy, so it's going to break down those fats.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I would say for fat loss, well, I'll say, here's how I look at physique enhancement. Cardio for fat loss, resistance training for muscle gain. That's kind of, if you want to lose fat, I don't like designing resistance training programs mm-hmm. around fat loss, because what I think the temptation is to do a huge amount of volume, not yeah. much intensity. And now that's kind of diluting the anabolic stimulus on the muscle. And cardio it's a beautiful and amazing fat loss tool. It works. Now you have to be careful. If it gets too extreme, you're gonna catabolize muscle, but I don't think that's as much of a concern as what a lot of people make it out to be. And I do hope in the next year to do some research on that area. A lot of people are cardiophobic because of the, what they think would happen to fat, to muscle loss. And I'll say this, if you're a female, yeah. you almost have nothing to worry about in oh. losing muscle. In every single case study that's ever been published in females, almost all, and again, so, you know, female bodybuilders, bikini competitors, they're dieting hard, they're doing cardio, they maintain nearly all of their muscle mass. And I'm relying on 5 case studies. I don't want you to think there's 80 of these. Okay. In all 5, maybe I think only one lost a little bit of fat-free mass. And you know, maybe that was water, who knows. But females are much more likely to lose all of their body weight from fat stores. Males lose a lot more muscle mass. And why? Well, they have more to lose. Maybe that's it. Mm-hmm. They also have a pretty big suppression of endogenous testosterone during a diet. Females don't have that. They start low, so they don't really have anywhere to go much lower. Oh. So those would be 2 reasons. There's one, listen to this. There's this study, this was a case study, it was, and this is freely available too. It's published last year, 2021. They looked at 2 bikini competitors. One was a master's level. She was like in her, I think, early 40s. The other one was in her 30s. I think it was the bikini competitor in her 40s. She did not diet at all. Her total contest prep was like 3 hours per day of stair climbing. And she didn't lose muscle mass.
Whoa.
So what was their protein intake? That's my question.
Oh, always high. Okay. Always high. Okay. I think we're looking at 1 gram per pound, if not even somewhat higher than that across the board.
So
always
in all
high.
Five studies, it's at least a pound, a gram per pound.
Single. Yeah, okay. And that's the lifestyle. I mean, if you're going mm-hmm. to optimize your physique, I think you're going to live a lifestyle of a high protein intake lifestyle. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't exceptions. I'm sure you guys probably know people that don't eat a lot of protein. And that carry. But here's something, and I just talked about this last night on another podcast, and this is highly, highly circumstantial, not based on data. Every female that I know that's just lean in her life, again, not even a competitor, and I'm at the point now, I go up to them, hey, I'm a physique scientist. Can I just ask, you know, and hopefully I don't come across as a creep, but I said, do you eat a lot of protein? And it's the answer is always yes, yes, yes. And these are the women that I'm looking at, they could have stepped on stage yesterday. So again, now that's circumstantial. It's just been my experience. But it is my experience.
Do you believe that someone can eat too much protein?
Yeah, I mean, at some point we don't have data to suggest it's unhealthy in healthy people. At some point, you're not getting much of a benefit. So I'll say this, in terms of just looking at muscle mass, the scientific consensus right now would say once you get past 1.6 grams per kg or let's say 0.75 grams per pound, you're really not getting much of you're getting less and less and less of a muscle building benefit as you get more and more and more protein intake past 1.6. Does that mean mm-hmm. that there's no benefit? I would say no, but it's less and less and less the more and more you take. The area that I tend to focus on is I think people only focus on muscle with protein and they don't appreciate body fat. So I'm aware of a few studies where if the subjects were resistance training and the only thing they increased was protein, even if they're in a caloric surplus, they don't gain body fat. And in some cases, they actually lose body fat. And this also goes back to my circumstantial evidence, my observations of lean females, they just have a pretty high protein diet lifestyle.
I had a question about vegan and vegetarian. Have you done any research with them on plant-based protein and the amount that they need versus somebody that's an omnivore?
I've not done that research. I have an opinion, and my opinion is as long as they're getting enough of the essential amino acids, I don't think that there would be any difference in those protein choices. But a plant-based is going to have to eat considerably more protein to get the high amounts of essential amino acids.
Right. Yeah. Since they're incomplete, that's why I was wondering if you. There was like a certain number that is more preferred for like a vegan versus an omnivore. So that makes sense. Was there anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted to share with our audience that we haven't asked you a question about?
I don't think so. I appreciate you guys asked very practical questions, and I'm sure your audience appreciates that. And again, I'm very appreciative that you reached out to me. I'm honored that you'd like to hear about my research and what I do. So thank you for making me feel special.
Yeah, no. we appreciate you being on, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. So thank you so much for your time. And I'm going to, of course, put in the show notes, you know, the link to your book and what your handle is on Instagram. Is there any preferred way that you want them to reach out if they have questions or to tell you how what they thought of the episode?
I'm pretty good at responding to DMs on Instagram, so that would be the best place.
Okay, perfect. Well, I'll put that in the show notes, and so that if any of you want to thank him or have a question for him, you can go ahead and reach out. If you would like to find us on Instagram, you can go to at Prep Life Podcast or at Glam Girl Bikini. Please tag us, show Dr. Campbell some love by tagging him on your story and letting him know what you thought of the episode. We always, always appreciate any type of ratings or reviews. So you can find us on Apple Podcasts and Podbean. For that, if you would like to apply for the team, you can go to glamgirlbikini.com. And we have a retreat coming up on February 19th and 20th in Phoenix, Arizona. We will have the link to sign up for the retreat as well in the show notes. And it's also on our bio on Instagram. This is your founder and CEO of Glam Girl Bikini, Amy Anger, signing off with my fabulous co-host.
And this is Chris Nicole, Glam Girl Bikini Coach and IFBB Bikini Pro. Thanks for listening, guys.